Welcome to Inside Sponsorship, the show that provides sponsorship professionals with advice, insights, and news so they can maximize their commercial programs and achieve best practice.
Hi everyone, and welcome to episode 4. I'm Daniel Oyston, host of the show. It's great to have you tuning in. We've put together another great show for you as we catch up with Sean Callanan from SportsGeek and talk about digital assets in your sponsorship program. Now, the chat with Sean is awesome and he gives some really great insights from his own practical experiences working with rights holders. And a massive thanks to Sean for his time because he was very, very generous in giving us close to an hour. But first, it's time for our regular segment with Mark Thompson. Now, we all agree that building and maintaining relationships is critical in this space, but how do you actually do that? What elements do you focus on? What tasks do you complete? Is often the hard part of it. So I caught up with Mark to discuss how to actually build relationships with sponsors. Here's Mark. Mark Thompson, welcome to the podcast.
G'day, Daniel.
Now, this is our fourth show. You've listened to all three.
Yep.
How do you think you went?
Probably about a 7 or 8 out of 10.
A safe number.
But I'm more excited that we're 20% towards CAC.
Yeah, right.
21st show.
I told you.
You promised me 21st show.
No, CAC. I did say don't hold me to it.
I'm going
to. I'll edit that out. Now, you'd be pleased to know the kids actually are enjoying listening to the show. I put it on in the car once or twice just to sort of hear, listen back to what we've been talking about. I'm not sure they're learning anything, but they're very excited when they hear you on the radio.
Really? Righto. Well, they are your kids. So,
We're out and about. We speak to lots of people clearly, and we like to check in and say, hey, did you read our latest blog? Did you enjoy it? Is there any topics that you'd like us to cover for you, questions you want us to answer? We get lots of positive feedback, but one theme that is probably a thread through everything that we do is clearly relationships. We quite often get asked about how do we actually, yes, I understand relationships are important, but how do I actually build them apart from just being friendly? And last week you blogged about 4 things that you personally really focus on when you're building a balanced and meaningful relationship. And I like the use of the word balance because there's often a couple of things at play. There's a bit of friendship. But at the core of it, it is a commercial relationship, isn't it?
Yeah, it sure is. And I'm not talking about becoming best mates with your sponsor, although sometimes friendship is a bit of a, you know, positive offshoot of having a good relationship. What I'm talking about is having that balanced communication which sort of gets across the transactional requirements that you need, but then also builds respect, and because you need your sponsor to respect you as a sponsorship professional. And the best way to do that is through a good balance of communication, so that the relationship isn't just about, as I said, what you've got to deliver them, but it's actually working together to try and reach that common goal.
So the first thing that you focus on is research.
Yeah, I research. I actually, when I sort of pulled this list apart, it forced me to sort of analyse what I do.
We know you hate spending time analysing things.
I love a bit of good analysis. So, which is probably why I don't mind working in the sponsorship space, but you know, I really broke it down to 4 key things. I've had a bit of a success in terms of high retention rates, luckily, throughout my career, and I've tried to break that down to, you know, why that could be. And the 4 key things that really stood out for me were, yes, number 1, research. And researching your sponsors is all about knowing exactly what's going on. And it's just as important to be researching your sponsors after you've got them on board. Obviously, to get them on board, we've spoken about that last episode, you've got to research them and know exactly how you're pitching to them. But knowing what's going on with them and staying up to date with what's happening within their business is really important.
How do you do that without just ringing them and saying, hey, what's going on? Nothing. How's life? Good.
Yeah, there's a couple of things. Read their website. So just, you know, be across their website. And
maybe be on their email lists.
Yeah, if you can get on newsletter lists and stuff like that, it's good. Often a lot of sponsors have multiple brands associated with them as well. So they'll have multiple websites. So and the corporate website may not necessarily have the day-to-day news. It'll have the objectives and all that sort of stuff. But the brand websites will sort of get you across what's happening exciting across their space and also present some opportunities perhaps that you can get involved. Following them on social media, both the organization pages and accounts, but also the actual contacts that you have, so their personal, you know, LinkedIn and things like that. basically what you get there is a bit of an idea of what people's, you know, thoughts of the world are, and you can start aligning with how they like to communicate, the type of words they use, the type of things they speak about, what they care about. So it helps to sort of pull that focus into what you can speak to them about and create a good bond. A good old Google search, just jump on Google.
And Google AdWords, setting up Google AdWords.
Yeah, Google AdWords and alerts is really, really good. They're free, they're easy. It comes to your inbox, so it doesn't really require a heap of effort, and it's kind of the same thing as a Google search. But what you'll find then is that you're kind of first to know if there's an announcement or a press release or something about the company, and you want to be prepared for anything that could adversely affect your relationship.
So research, we're prepared. Yep. Number two, communication.
Communication. So this is a no-brainer, obviously, but how do you do it effectively is the question that we got asked. So balance is the key. We've spoken about that at the start of the show. And there's four, within this sort of thing, there's four methods of communication that I like to use, and it helps force the balance. So obviously email, and if to even break that down further, what I use email for is for that ongoing communication and insights piece and information sharing, just an update or forwarding them a cool video or something like that. Telephone, really good for that regular, just, hey mate, how are you going? Wanted to see how your life is. That's sort of just a really quick 30-second touch base just to let them know you're alive and thinking of them. Face-to-face. This is actually still, it's old school, but it's still, I believe, the most powerful tool, because in sponsorship, I think people still do business with people. So, it's important to have these catch-ups. Doesn't have to be every week. We might only do two or three a year or something, but you've got to have them.
Yeah, it's an interesting angle, because it's one of my favourite sayings, people do business with people.
I learned it from you.
It's good to see you're paying attention. But interestingly, I think we can let relationships fall into a groove of text messages and emails and maybe a quick phone call, and everything feels like it's going okay, but you don't realise you're not doing the face-to-face until something goes wrong. And you think, ooh, actually, I'm probably not as far ahead in that relationship as I thought I was.
Yeah, and also when you're, nowadays sponsorship isn't just sort of local community related. It's with the, advent of television and social media and stuff like that, more and more organisations are securing sponsorships outside of where they're located. So when you are in town where your sponsor's located, put aside an hour in your diary and go and see him for a coffee for a half hour. It doesn't have to be to achieve anything other than just, hey, I'm in town, I thought it would be good service to come and see you, can I buy your coffee?
Yeah. So did you just say maybe 2 to 3 times a year face-to-face?
I think that's a good enough balance. And you'll have more, when the need pops up. Obviously in a renewal year and stuff like that, you're going to have some actual business meetings with them. But those face-to-faces are just really a quick status check, and depends on the size of your portfolio, how resourced you are in your organization, how much spare time you have on your hands in terms of actually delivering and managing your sort of program. But a good balance for me is probably 2 to 3 times.
And I think I'm a big fan of putting regular things in your diary, so rather than just getting to the start of the week and thinking, oh, I'll ring some sponsors and see if I can have a coffee, and not booking any in and maybe booking some for a couple of weeks ahead. If you've got a spot in your diary, you're conscious about filling it. It reminds me of a story, a bloke I used to know, I used to play footy with, he told me, this is back in the days of taking clients out for long boozy lunches, and his boss used to walk around the floor, because he was a consultant, his boss used to walk around the floor basically tapping people on the shoulder if you weren't out having lunch with clients. So clearly lunchtime was the time that they should have been sort of semi-socializing and building relationships with the clients, not actually delivering the work. But if you put that in your diary, it's a conscious thing that you have to fill rather than going, oh yeah, I'll get to coffees.
Yeah, that's right. And it seems to be really insignificant and something that can get bumped off your calendar, a coffee catch up, because it kind of feels social. Any CEO or CFO or anything in an organisation will sort of tell you that retention is the number one priority in sponsorship, not signing new ones, because you don't want to have to. So relationships is the key to that.
Number three, it's thinking about it as more than just a transaction.
Yeah, that's right. So, and this is, it's a really hard one to get your head around how you do this. Some people are just not natural communicators. And so they feel like they're doing a really good job by delivering benefits only. But there's a space for delivering benefits, but there's also a space to just try and engage with a sponsor. And some sponsors will be a closed shop too. But there's a couple of sort of, you know, key pointers that you can go about. And I said this a few episodes ago, you know, listening is really important in these situations. Let them speak. Ask them questions about themselves. You know, try and find out a bit about them, you know, where their organization's heading, where they're heading as individuals, what their career goals are. Be transparent about yourself as well. You know, talk about your business, where you guys are heading, what your ambitions are, where you personally want to achieve. But don't make it about you. Just participate in the conversation. But also, when talking business, be specific and sort of investigate and dig down on how you guys can work together. Because, you know, there's nothing wrong with throwing ideas on the table. But if you don't throw ideas on the table, that's when you won't drive stuff forward. So you could talk with somebody about something that never goes forward, but you've got to talk to them about that something. And that's not regarding what you've got to deliver to them. That's regarding, oh, they've got a new product launch coming up. Throw ideas at them how they can use your brand to help drive that. It's going to create that stickiness.
So it's not just a transaction, which means that sometimes that relationship with a sponsor does morph into a friendship, yep. Sometimes just a little one, sometimes a very good one. Have you had any that have, how do I put this, the commercial aspect of the relationship maybe suffers a little bit because the friendship grows too much? Is that a danger?
I've become really good friends with a few of my corporate partners, but often the person you've got the relationship with isn't the one that at the end of the day will decide, no, you've got no more money to spend. They'll be potentially the one that, yes, we've got the money, who do you want to spend it on? That's where, you know, you're probably in a good spot if you've got a good relationship with them. But, you know, being professional and you know, being good at your job is paramount over any friendship anyway. You know, we've all had to make hard decisions around friends and business, and this is no different.
And be yourself.
Be yourself. This is one of my real big sort of gripes.
So walk around without your shirt on and, you know, like you do at home? Is that what you're saying?
No, I don't walk around without my shirt on. I would like to keep my marriage intact. But nothing annoys me more than when I see someone acting how they think another person wants them to act, you know. Because at the end of the day, there's going to come a point where they see how you really are and it creates doubt straight away. You know, is this person genuine? And then it sort of filters on to other things. Are they going to deliver what they want? It just creates a bit of distrust.
Well, and doubt around everything that you say.
Yeah. Basically, my sort of philosophy is I will be who I am and people can either take it or leave it, and that may be the difference between if we become really good mates or not friends or whatever, but they will always respect me because I'll deliver what I promise. I'll do it professionally and I'll do it on time. They're my sort of key pillars in how I operate, but I act how I act. So, you know, I'm me. And, you know, it really gets on my nerves sometimes when I see people in a social setting acting one way and then in a business setting acting another, because I don't know who the real person is.
Yeah, because it's nice potentially if a commercial relationship blossoms into a friendship, but that's not the purpose of it. And we quite often get stuck in those situations at work. We spend a lot of time with people and we create some great friendships, and sometimes that impacts on us being able to actually do our job. So it's important to keep that in mind.
Exactly. But there's a couple of caveats there as well, right? So being yourself doesn't mean that, you know, if you're generally a late person, that you turn up late to meetings, or, you know, if you're generally a sort of sloppy dresser, that you dress sloppy. What I'm saying is act yourself.
Be genuine.
You know, in terms of how you present yourself from a business point of view, but still, you know, be on time to meetings, stay professional, dress respectively. I think I said in my blog that be your before 10 p.m. self.
What's that mean?
Well, you know, before you've had a few drinks and you're a bit of a lunatic.
Oh, 10 p.m. I thought you said 10 a.m.
No. and listen rather than talk.
Generally, I'm sober before 10 a.m.
Hopefully. And one more thing. I've got a little trick that I try and use, and it's a little formula that I use to try and make sure that I keep that balanced communication. And it's for every one piece of communication that I have with a sponsor where I'm asking for something or delivering something, a transactional, I try and have five other non-transactional pieces of communication. So, and that's balanced across email, social, phone calls, and face-to-face. But my one in five rule, you know, has worked for me across multiple commercial roles I've had. And I think it's a good one to take forward.
And so give it a go. And if your ratio is 1-3 or 1-10, you've got to find your own groove, don't you?
Correct.
So if people want to read that blog in its entirety, just head along to sponserve.net. There'll be a link in the show notes, or you can see the blog as a standalone piece. If anybody's got any questions, they can get in contact with you.
Cheers, mate.
Thank you.
See you next week.
In our guest interview this episode, we catch up with Sean Callanan from SportsGeek. SportsGeek offers expertise in sports digital marketing to allow you to focus on your core business. Now, SportsGeek will keep you up to date with the latest sports digital trends to build your digital fan base and deliver terrific results for your sponsors. SportsGeek want to get you results in your sports digital efforts, and if you're not happy, then they'll give you your money back. So with that confidence, I thought there must be some great advice at SportsGeek, and that's why I invited Sean Callanan on the show. Sean Callanan from SportsGeek, welcome to Inside Sponsorship.
Thanks very much, mate.
Sean, to set the scene a little bit, can you give us a bit of a rundown of what SportsGeek does and maybe some examples of some of your clients?
So I started SportsGeek 7 years ago now. Before I was SportsGeek, I was a regular geek. I was an IT coder developer working in the IT industry for 15 years. But I always did that as a frustrated sports fan. And so I started SportsGeek to help sports in that space, in the digital space, and started at a time when social media was really, really developing. So I found myself at the right place in the right time. Initially did a lot of consulting and training of teams around how to use social and how to use social to engage. And now that's become a broader, I guess, digital strategy piece. So probably the best way to describe what I do and what we do at SportsGeek is I'm a digital strategist on call for sports teams and leagues and athletes. So digital teams have built up in the sports sector over the past 7 years, and I advise them on campaigns, content strategy, and also sponsorship campaigns and how sponsors can best leverage digital. So I think that best explains what SportsGeek does. As far as who we work with the FFA and A-League, have been doing that for a couple of years, and it's been taking up a fair chunk of the summer, also with the NBL and Melbourne United, and now we're heading into football season, so I'm on calls with teams like Collingwood and the Adelaide Crows and the South Sydney Rabbitohs and the North Queensland Cowboys. So it keeps me pretty busy, and it's really good to be working across all those different sports.
And those rights holders, they have big audiences, and engaging with those audiences is attractive for sponsors. But the fans want engaging content, and sometimes even personalised content, and not just content that interrupts them or, you know, yells or sells at them. Let's say a brand has just come on as a sponsor or is maybe thinking about it, and the rights holder has a large digital following. Where should they together start in terms of figuring out what content they can produce to help activate that sponsorship?
Yeah, so I guess initially, and you know, you sort of pointed to it with the large numbers, a lot of sponsors are now drawn to sports because they're seeing the large social followings, hundreds of thousands of Facebook fans, or, you know, if you're talking about Cristiano Ronaldo now with 200 million digital fans around the world, like, sponsors are attracted to that. And a lot of the time when I'm talking to sponsors, probably on the other side of the table, whether it be a league or a team, I have to sort of retrain them to not look at that number, because it's not about that big number. It's about their audience. And where sports works really well, and where digital works really well, is in the niche, or the niche, if you have any listeners in the US.
Yeah, we have a few.
It's about diving into the data. So if the Rabbitohs have 400,000 Facebook fans, or Collingwood has 350,000 Facebook fans, you know, it's a bit naive to think you're going to reach and get your message to all of them. But you also need to remember that not all of them can be your customers. So you need to really match what your needs are and what your audience is with what you're doing from a sponsorship activation in digital point of view. So you really have to know, you know, what your audience and customers you want to target with the message, and also the objectives of the campaign. Are you looking to get your, you know, is it a brand awareness play? Are you trying to get your name out there and, you know, having the halo effect of being associated with the sports team? Or are you doing something that's more sales focused? Are you trying to get sales leads? Are you trying to attract data to get people interested in your into your product or brand? So I think that's the first thing, not to think, you know, not to see all the big digital numbers as a silver bullet, but really as a starting point to have a conversation with potentially your customers that are in that fan base.
In a survey late last year by IEG, sponsorship decision makers ranked access to digitally related assets higher than they ever have, while broadcast and traditional advertising elements held less appeal to them. But to be clear, they are actually rated as equally important. But the point is that the presence in digital, social, mobile didn't even rate in the survey the year before. So I've got sort of a two-pronged question. Firstly, what's changed in the past sort of 12 to 18 months to create the importance? And why have sponsors been so slow to see the importance of digital assets in rights holders when it's likely that other elements of their brand have long embraced them?
Yeah, so I can give you the short smart aleck response is that a lot of marketers have watched the Social Network movie and decided that they need to move more money in there. but I guess a longer form answer is a lot of brand marketers tried using digital and social and to a certain degree failed because fans, you know, fans of consumer brands or fast-moving goods or car brands, they don't really particularly want to engage with those brands on social. And so I think that, I guess, that pullback in the last 12 to 18 months is a little bit of marketing departments of those brands saying, well, we've tried building our own community around our brand on Facebook, or we've tried doing stuff on Twitter, or we've tried to build out microsites that engage our customers. And they've been pretty fleeting in success. Like you can see some working, but it's pretty tough to be driving to drive digital channels for pretty much a stock standard brand. Whereas sport, this is why it's so appealing both to the networks that we're talking about, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram and Snapchat and the like. You know, sports is premium content for those platforms, and you've got a highly engaged audience, an audience that identifies with the team. You know, especially here in Australia, your relationship with your football team really forms a big part of your identity. So, you know, sponsors have that ability to attach themselves to that. So, you know, in previous years, you know, 5-10 years ago, that attachment would have been by, you know, showing a sponsor patch on the jumper and putting signage around the stadium, and now digital is offering, I guess, those assets in a digital and a social form. So that's the appealing piece from a sponsorship point of view. As long as they get that match right of what they're trying to do, and getting their brand values and their audience to be in line with what the team is trying to do, whether it be around a specific piece of content or a specific campaign. Because if there's any fracture in that alignment, the fans see right through it, and, you know, it won't get the results that you want. But, you know, that's the appealing thing that still drives sponsors into sport, the fact they've got a really highly passionate fan base and the responses that they can get with a well-run campaign with the sports team, you know, far outweighs any campaign that they could do without that association.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting point that a lot of brands have tried and not been massively successful in building engaged audiences, or that it's only fleeting.
Yeah, I think the main thing was early early in social media, so 2010, 2011, 2012, there was a real big push of community. Community is what you need to develop, and community is the long game. And community is a very long, it is a long game, and it is a hard thing to measure ROI. And so you saw a lot of agencies out there pitching that as the main pitch. This is how you do social. You go build a community. You get a community manager. You push out all this content. And that hasn't converted. So, you know, more and more brands are moving to, you know, using the platforms as they're intended, and especially using all the advertising options that are now available and looking for that direct sale. And effectively what sports can offer, it could offer that community aspect partly, but it also can offer that direct, you know, that direct result benefit of, well, if we run a cool campaign, we can, you know, get more customers by getting their data, or we can drive more people into our store because they're running a promotion and it's being promoted on digital platforms, or we could just sell more stuff.
So on that, yep. With you just started to rattle off some of those objectives, and that was going to be my next question. What are some of the big objectives that sponsors look to achieve in accessing digital properties? Or to spin it around for the listeners who are mostly sponsorship and commercial managers, what should they be saying they can help sponsors achieve through accessing digital assets?
So, you know, so from a team side, if I'm working with a commercial or a sponsorship team, and they're starting to look at a digital activation or something with the sponsor, you know, my first question is, what do they really want? You know, it really dives into that objective. And as a sponsorship executive, if you don't know what your sponsor wants, then how can you deliver a successful campaign? You know, so it really does start with asking the sponsor, what do they want? Then I normally follow it up with, no, really, what do you want? And then I follow up with, what do you really, really want? And it's a bit repetitive, but unless they actually, you know, that you want something definitive, you know, one of the questions that always works well is, you know, what would you consider a success, you know, what outcome would you consider successful for this campaign? And then you start getting some of the numbers. And it might be in some, but as long as you can show that our brand was in front of this many people in this demographic, then we're happy, right? So it's just a pure brand awareness play, and they can show to their, you know, their CMO and their executives that, you know, that their message was in front of a million people. And so they're just really using digital instead of TV and running an ad. And that might be one play. I don't think many sponsors are still in that space. For instance, you know, Holden isn't partnering with Collingwood for brand awareness because everyone knows who Holden is. So they would be doing something more along the lines of, well, we want to sell more cars. So once you have that objective, you should then be building out all your assets and building out all your offerings, whether it be content offerings and campaign offerings, that get to that objective. Because if you're just saying, oh, here's our sponsor, we're going to put their logo on this piece of content and we're going to mention them on the big screen and we're going to tweet at them on the full-time score and we're going to run a campaign that gives away a jumper, that might be fine to tick all the boxes for a brand awareness sponsor, but if someone wants to sell cars, that's not going to do it. So you really have to make sure that you're not just selling inventory. You're not just saying, oh, here's the 6 Facebook posts that you're going to get, but really I'm very big on, and it's going to be my keynote for this year at a few conferences, that sports and sponsorship have the opportunity to think like an agency and take the problem that a sponsor has, you know, take that objective and come back with a bespoke solution for that. Not just saying, oh, we've got this and this and this and we're going to give you that and there's our value, but coming back and saying, well, we believe this campaign will, you know, sell more cars or, you know, get more people buying donuts or whatever the objective is, because you've built that campaign specifically around their goals. And to me, that's the key, to have that mindset of trying to solve a solution, solve a problem that your sponsor might have. Then when it gets to the, you know, the discussion of renewal and that kind of thing, it shouldn't be awkward, because you could pretty much go back to that original question of, what was our key success indicators? Well, you asked for this and that's what we delivered. There really shouldn't be much negotiation needed.
I think there's a couple of interesting points or angles in there. Two of them, I'll be interested in your thoughts. Clearly, you're on the same page as us at Sponserve in that we think that those conversations around what you're trying to achieve should be pushed forward in the conversation with a sponsor before they come on board, and focus specifically on the benefits that you're offering that sponsor or the inventory you're offering them. But my view is that there's two things at play here. Digital is very easy to add into a sponsorship program without it costing the rights holder something, but also that digital can be anything. Signage at a ground, we know, is mostly around brand awareness. Tickets to the director's lunch is mostly about networking or entertaining clients. So on face value, those benefits are traditional. They're easy to see. You know, they only have a couple of benefits, but digital could be anything. It could be about qualified leads, brand awareness, engage. It could be. And so my view is that a lot of sponsorship managers are putting them in there to help pad out agreements or proposals, and people say, yes, we want to be involved in social media. But then the conversation happens later about, okay, what are you going to do with it? Which for me is way too late.
Yeah, so, I mean, I've been involved in those conversations, I guess, over the last 18 months, 2 years, more and more of my time and work has been with the commercial teams. And partly it's a skill set. They've always sold the hospitality, they've always sold the signage. Like you said, it's an easy thing to sell. Whereas, you know, what we're trying to do with our clients is get some digital now, whether it be from the digital team or someone like myself, in those initial meetings. They don't have to be pitching. They don't have to be, they can be seen, but they don't need to be heard. But as long as they're listening in to what the sponsor is looking for, so then, you know, when you're taking in those objectives and goals, and then you'll come back with a proposal, if you've got someone with, you know, some digital savviness there, they will know that, oh, this kind of campaign is what we should be pitching back. So, you know, that's where, you know, I'm lucky enough to talk to digital execs and sponsor execs around the world, you know, with what I do with SportsGeek, and that shift seems to be happening. There seems to be more of digital departments servicing and being more in partnership with sponsorship, and I find myself in that space a lot to say, look, here's the capacity of what the digital team can do. We really need to make sure that the sponsorship team or the commercial team, whatever it's named, knows what those capacities are, so you can, you know, better deliver it. Because you're right, digital can be anything, and it's a matter of, you know, knowing what you can deliver to get that result for the sponsor.
So how do you actually then balance the sponsor's integration and some good content so that the digital following and engagement stays high for a rights holder, whilst still generating real value for those sponsors who are accessing that asset? Is there do you think there's a set balance or ratio, or is it really just about quality over quantity?
So the only key word there is integration more than anything else. So what, you know, what we do regularly with clients at the end of the year is to, you know, review all the content that was published. And we can see quite clearly if it's a blatant sponsor post, you know, something like, here's a special offer from our trade partner, or please go down to this shop and buy something, that both the fans don't like it and people like Facebook, as far as the post goes, don't promote it, because they can see that it's a sponsored message in effect. Mm. So it's a matter of better integrating that messaging or that offer into the content that you are producing. So it might be putting that offer at the tail end of a really good content piece that people watch, or it might be putting that offer inside a video that, you know, the fans are watching. But the other thing is also to understand who you're pitching that for and who needs to see that. If you're trying to sell, you know, car tires, it doesn't make sense if you're going to put it with a piece of content that's really engaged with your teen audience, because they're not going to buy car tires. So
they asked Dad to do that for them.
Yeah, exactly. But it's a bit in that space. But then also, And it is a trend that we're seeing with partners and friends in the US, is that if you're looking, and pretty much because Facebook is now asking for it, if you're looking for a paid result, and so a paid result from a digital team would be looking to sell tickets, you're looking to sell merchandise, or you're looking to promote a sponsor product or a sponsor message or a sponsor campaign, then it should have some paid advertising behind it. And so most of the teams, you know, in the US are now doing that. And, you know, that's what we're doing with some of our clients, because if you were just to say, here's my post from a sponsor, it's going to go up at 6 o'clock at night, it's only going to be in the feed of your average fan for a couple of hours. Whereas if you put some advertising behind it, you can both lengthen the post time frame in the fans' view, but also make sure that the actual fans that need to see it, if I use the tyre example again, you make sure that car owners and people who drive are actually the ones that are seeing it. You can give multiple metrics back to your partner of this is who saw it, this is how many saw it, this is how many clicked through, this is how many people went to the page, this is how many people opted in, all of that kind of thing. And it sets you up for a bit more success, because if you're simply relying on the platform to promote your message, Facebook's made it pretty clear that, you know, if it's content that the fans don't want, or if it's sponsored content anyway, then they will actually go out of their way to restrict that kind of content.
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting. You were just mentioning metrics there. The IEG survey I mentioned earlier also noted that 65% of sponsors said that rights holders didn't meet their expectations in helping them measure their return on investment or objectives. But it also said that 51% of sponsors spend 1% or less on actually measuring that return. Is that the rights holder's role, or does it fall more with the sponsor? And irrespective, why do people find it so hard to measure return on investment in this space?
Well, I think it comes back to there's a fair chunk of, on both sides, of not knowing what they want. So how can you measure something you don't know what it is? Like, that's my main thing. Like, I'll just say, oh, we spent $200,000, you know, we didn't see any sales, or something along those lines. So I have had a sponsor say to me, well, I spent $100,000 for the short sponsorship, I expected a lot more Facebook likes. And I'm like, well, if you had told me that, then that's what we would drive the campaign to get you more Facebook likes. But really, it's not the most effective spend of $100,000 if that's what you want. So it does come back to that question of what is success, and then you can track that. But if that's not defined early on, then it's always going to be rights holders coming back saying they didn't meet their expectations. I think if we can, you know, if the IAG survey asked, was that clearly defined? And that, to me, that's the bigger issue. But from a rights holder point of view, you should be, you know, there's no point in producing reports that don't show that you're having, that you're providing a successful result. You know, some sponsors won't care what the reach is or how many impressions something had, right? Again, if their main goal is to sell more stuff or drive more people in store or acquire data. But when someone says, I'm going to run this campaign and I want 2,000 emails, that's very easy to measure. That's very easy to drive a digital team to get that outcome. So that's where it's a bit of, as a sponsor, be very clear on what you want. I mean, and then as a rights holder, chase that down and report that. Everything else is really, is just, is fluff. Really.
And if they want to know more, they're going to ask you, what's a unique view versus total visitors, or click-throughs versus open rates and stuff like that?
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole, you know, stats are meaningless in some sense. You know, I think the stat is 33% of all stats are made up, including that one.
You know, I heard it was 50 yesterday.
Yeah. I mean, like, that's the thing. You can make stats and you sort of get into bamboozle mode. And really, if, you know, if you have one key objective, you can use the other stuff as supporting evidence and that kind of thing. But really, it should, you should just have that top line number, whether it is, data captured, store traffic, audience delivered, those kind of things that you can go back with. And if you focus on them, then like all the work that you have to do to report it and all that kind of stuff becomes a lot simpler if you just focus on, one key metric for them.
And it'll probably save you time because you're not pulling together a whole lot of what you would consider key metrics, but the sponsor doesn't.
Exactly.
It seems to me as though that the skill is on the rights holder's side. If the sponsor isn't clear what they want, it's the skill is on the rights holder's side to really force that out of them rather than go with the flow in the negotiation and proposal side, helps you get off on the right foot. And clearly that has flow through benefits right through the relationship. But I wondered whether you just said something interesting before about, I spent $200,000 and I expected more Facebook likes. I wondered if you ask, what do you want? No, what do you really want? No, what do you really, really want? I wonder if we can add a question in there that flips it around and plays devil's advocate and says, you're the sponsor, it's the end of the first year, I spent $100,000 and I expected, and try and get them to fill in the blank.
Yeah, and that's pretty much what that last really want question is. You want them to answer it in that manner. If I put the renewal in front of you right now, what is the first thing you're going to ask yourself or ask your CMO or what your CEO is going to ask you on why it's happening? That's the bit you want to get.
Hmm.
And then you can work with your digital teams and go back to them and say, can we help these guys sell more, couches, right? Then you need to figure out if you can do it, but at least knowing that is the important piece. So that, can you drive back to awareness when you are showing them lots of stats? Are you driving back to data, an opt-in kind of thing where you say, here's the kind of thing, or it might be just a pure engagement thing. They might just want to be engaged with your audience, and that way you might do things that provide a lot of engagement and you provide the stats around that. But they're normally the three that they all pivot off. It's just a matter of boiling them down into one of those three.
So it seems statistically, and through what you focus on with working with organisations, that digital is the way forward, and it has the benefit of being a low-cost deliverable from a sponsorship manager's point of view. How do you decide which sponsors should get access and which ones will actually get value from these digital activations? Does making sure the sponsor can create content that enhances the rights holders' channels and image and follower engagement play an important role, or should it really be more on the rights holders' side to create the content for the sponsor to ensure engagement?
So I think no one knows the sports fan base better than the team itself. I always find that when sponsor-driven content is pitched into an organisation, it's normally a little bit clunky and it's not quite, on brand and on voice and have the same tone as if it came from the team. I think the capacity now of digital teams at league level and at team level, they can produce digital campaigns that can produce results for sponsors, and it works best when it's on their site and on their properties. So I think that's where it is, that sort of think like an agency model for a club to come back and say, this is what we're going to do, this is how we're going to do it, and go that way. And so it gives the rights holder, gives the team the ability to potentially upsell their proposal, because effectively you're getting into the activation budget of the sponsorship. Then you've just got to decide whether that's part of the proposal or not part of the proposal. And sometimes that becomes that awkward conversation where the sponsorship team has sold some assets, but they haven't really sold a campaign. And then when you're having that, like I said, that discussion of what type of campaign do you want, then it comes down to who pays, that kind of thing. So from a team point of view, they should be looking to take on that work, obviously get paid for that work, but be able to provide that solution. I think it works best when it's an in-house play.
Yeah, we come across lots of rights holders that have sold not just digital assets, but also, you know, physical activations around game days and stuff like that. The bigger teams and sports are pretty good at following that through, but there are a lot of mid-level and smaller sports organisations that get to the end of the agreement, and the sponsor had no idea really how to access the Facebook posts. It sounded like it was good,
yep.
or even that physical activations at the events, and they went, well, I didn't really know what an activation was. I thought you were going to tell me what to do. So there really is an opportunity to lead those sponsors by the hand and potentially even bring more revenue into the organisation.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the classic stadium activation is a good example. A sponsor gets pitched, oh, you're going to have a stadium activation and we're going to give away those horrid thunder sticks. and, you know, 10,000 of the things are bought and the sponsorship exec will send off a invoice to the sponsor saying, here's the cost of the thunder sticks. And most of the time, sponsors go, oh, okay, yeah, that makes sense. But then there's a bit of a culture of, oh, digital doesn't cost anything. And if you want to run a campaign and set it up, it doesn't cost anything. And it does, because it costs manpower to drive it and run it. There may be tools behind the scenes and that kind of thing. So this, I think it's a fallacy to say digital is a low-cost deliverable, because, you know, there's a reason there's now 10 people working in a digital department. They're not doing it all for love. You know, so there is a cost. There is a cost there. And then there may be tools that are available that also make that viable. But it's just a matter of reframing that conversation to say, well, from an activation point of view, we might run this really killer campaign and it's going to be, you know, 10, 15, 25K to run that campaign and it's going to have your branding all over it and the fans are going to love it and this is what we need to build it out. I think that conversation, you know, is starting to happen more with sponsors and rights holders.
I think it's a good point around digital isn't actually a low-cost option. I think that question that
I think it's better to say it's cost-effective.
Yeah, well, I think the question was mostly framed around how people position it to a sponsor. They go, oh, well, you know, we can put some Facebook posts up. And in their head, they go, well, it doesn't cost anything to put it up. But what they're not factoring in is the, like you said, the tools behind the scenes, the production value, the manpower that goes into the thoughts, even the promotion and payment of getting that in people's news feeds more often.
So, yeah, so this is a piece also that I'm also retraining both commercial execs and sponsors. Don't confuse cost with value. Okay, it might cost $2,000 to create a sign that's going to be posted on the boundary at the NCG. They don't sell it for $2,000 because the value is different. And so it might cost 5 minutes of someone's time to post something on Facebook, but that doesn't mean that its value is worth that amount of time, because you're reaching 60,000, 70,000, 100,000. Quarter of a million people. So that's the piece that early on, a lot of digital was thrown in with the steak knives to deals, and I had to retrain a bunch of people in the digital and the sponsorship space to say, well, if you're going to give something away for nothing, how is the sponsor going to value it? How is the sponsor going to see that as of any value? And then it's very hard to double the price of something that's something zero, because my math still says it's zero. So
mine too.
You've got to start putting, you've got to put value on those digital assets and move, disassociate it with the cost that happens. You know, if someone says, well, we're going to do 5 tweets and we value our tweets at this, a partner says, oh, but it doesn't cost anything to put out a tweet. And it's not about the cost. It's about the value. It doesn't cost Channel 9 anything to hit play on the ad that gets run on Big Bang Theory, right? But they charge a lot of money for it because it has value.
Yeah.
So, I'm happy with cost price, cost plus pricing of sponsorship, where you say, well, it's going to cost us $10,000 to do this, but from a value proposition, because we know it's going to hit 500,000 fans, we think it's worth this much. And then you can start the discussion. But you really want to dissociate at a cost and value, because they're two different propositions.
Couldn't agree more. I wanted to do a bit of a whistle-stop tour of the bigger social media platforms and look at some good sponsorship activations, either in partnership with or on the rights holders' platforms. So can you give us an example of a great sponsorship activation and why it was good, something you've seen on Facebook?
So I looked at this because all the channels that you ping me about are all about, you know, that they are just that channel. So most campaigns end up in some form or another running on multiple channels.
Yep.
So from my point of view, Facebook does offer you a lot because it's got the most mature advertising product and targeting product behind the scenes. So, you know, there's a couple of different things that can be done in the Facebook space, whether it be, you know, driving to a digital property, whether it be a mini site or a data capture type form that work quite well, that you can run both, you know, on Facebook as a standard post, but then you can be running as a dark post. So if people don't know, a Facebook dark post is an ad that looks like a post, looks like it's just on your wall, but it only is seen by people you're advertising to. So, you know, a lot of teams have used Facebook as that distribution channel to drive traffic, because Facebook is one that does drive a lot of traffic to sports, but drive traffic to your digital property that, you know, gets the result. And that's normally, you know, some sort of landing page where the competition sits or that kind of thing. So Facebook, because, you know, 14 million Australians are on Facebook, that's the platform that is sort of best to activate, you know, the broad campaign, but also the campaign where you want to dive in on, here's people who are fans of our team that we know are engaged in our database, that fits the demographic profile of our sponsor and potentially already like our sponsor. So that's where Facebook really excels. From a Twitter point of view, Twitter is more in that play-by-play. Twitter is where live kicks in. So Twitter loves sports and it loves entertainment, things like the Oscars, because that's when people are tuning into Twitter.
Yep.
So it can be a good way for a sports team to introduce the brand and that kind of thing. Unfortunately, their ad product to support that kind of thing is a little bit clunky and hasn't really delivered the results or the same results as Facebook. So I haven't had many teams sort of using that to amplify what they're trying to do from a Twitter point of view.
Do you think that's because Twitter doesn't filter the newsfeed?
Oh, there's a bit of that. It's partly because ads on Twitter really, really stand out and people really, really rail against ads. Whereas a lot of people don't realise that Facebook ads are Facebook ads. So I think there's that part of it. Also, I think it's a market thing. There's not as many people on Twitter. You know, Twitter hasn't done the best job in growing the fan, growing the user base in Australia. They won't. At the moment, they're not releasing how many people are using it in Australia. So I pretty much tell everyone it's 3 million people, because I can't see anything more that says that they've got more than that. So it's not a big, broad, you know, you're not reaching a lot of people. But Twitter works if you've got a sponsor that's in on that platform. So if you've got a sponsor that's really active in that space and is doing innovative things and talking back to their fans and their customers, then that, you know, that's where your digital person should be sitting there listening, going, "Oh, that sponsor's really heavily invested on Twitter. We know our audience is really, our fans on Twitter are really invested. That will be a good partnership." So it only makes sense if the partner is on that platform. I think if you had a partner that wasn't using Twitter, then it doesn't make much sense.
Oh, let alone all the education you've got to try and get through to convince them that it's a good platform potentially.
Exactly. So it's no good pitching a sponsor a platform where they're not on, unless they're, you know, about to bike down on launching really heavily on that platform. From an Instagram point of view, you know, it's very much a growth platform. It's past Twitter. It's about 4.5, approaching 5 million users in Australia. And again, because it's now launched, it has that same, because Instagram, as people don't know, is owned by Facebook, it has the same targeting capabilities that Facebook does. It's still a newish ad product, so there's a lot of bad ads out there because it's nothing opens up the door to bad marketers like a new ad platform. So the thing is, you know, content can be put out by a team that has a highly engaged fan base, and it can drive traffic. So my suggestions with anything you're doing on Instagram, it still should be in the style and voice of what Instagram is, which is, you know, photo platform, engagement, that kind of thing. So it's going to be counter to what the ads might be. You know, the ads are meant to drive people off to a website. But for, you know, 5 years, no one's ever left Instagram. Mm. They've always just stayed in there. So, you know, don't go and say, hey, go to this site and buy a new Holden. How about you just profile that Holden is part of your content, promote it, and then get people to engage and comment and like on that post. So I think that, you know, that's a place where Instagram, you know, can play, but it's more in that brand awareness. You know, how great are our sponsors? You know, even the subtle stuff of, you know, getting a sponsor logo, you know, in the foreground of a really great shot of the players or the stadium or that kind of thing. It's those kind of nuances that I think can be appreciated on an Instagram.
I think the sponsors need to make an effort to be, like you've said a couple of times, be part of the platform. If you're just going to run an ad, it stands out on Twitter. That's why it hasn't been so good. But Facebook ads look like they're part of it. And if they're taking the approach of, for one of, it's a bit of a stretch, but say we're part of the community here and we're here to participate rather than try and suck you off somewhere else, that's where it's going to work.
Yep. Yeah, exactly.
Now, we know you love Snapchat.
Yep.
Talk to us about Snapchat.
Those three are the three main players and have sort of been the three main players over the past couple of years. The one that is chasing them down is Snapchat. And if there's any platform that brands, that completely confuses and mystifies brands, it's Snapchat. You know, it's home of the millennials, where, you know, every 16, 24-year-old is on that platform. Most of the athletes are on that platform. Some of them not using it correctly. Shout out to Jay Carlisle. But the thing is, it's a great storytelling platform. So it gives the clubs a really great way to explain or to tell the story of game day and develop that experience. So this is what game day is like. A lot of the fans are going to be doing it. And so that's where, potentially, you know, sponsors could be integrated into that story. It's going to take a little bit of, you know, I think the clubs need to learn how to use the platform more. So it's, you know, it's developing worldwide. There's a few teams doing a good job. And then it's going to be a matter of how can sponsors be involved in that space. Because really, if I was a sponsor and someone had charged me to launch a Snapchat channel, they would just be mystified on how they would go about doing it. Like, how would they engage? How would they get people to watch their stories? Whereas fans are going to be following their sports team. So there is a place that you could potentially integrate. Now, you've got to do that. It's definitely a tread softly because, you know, the millennial audience is a fickle one, and if you go too hard in that space, they will turn around and go the opposite direction. So
it's interesting because
from a growth point of view, it's a big opportunity.
Yeah, I agree, because it's interesting because I see lots of opportunities for a platform like Snapchat. So, for example, the Brumbies here in Canberra have got brand new hospitality packages, and one of those is going into the change rooms and all that sort of stuff, right? For me, it's about taking the fans that are sitting in front of the TV on their second device, or it might even be their third device, like their phones and their iPads, and using Snapchat in partnership with a sponsor to help take those people in the living room in behind the game day. Snapchat's a perfect platform for that.
Yep. Yeah. Oh, it is. It is. And, and it is that storytelling element. So you don't have to be tuning in live. You can go to the game or you can be out and then you can go, oh, what happened to the game? And you can open up and it'll tell you. It tells the story sequentially. You can see what happened at the start of the day. You can see the crowd going off. You can see what happened in the president's lunch, and you can get a bit of a bird's eye view into areas of the stadium you don't normally get to, and it sort of can give you that feel. Well, oh gee, I really should be at the next game, or I should be at the next Port Hospitality thing. So that's the opportunity potentially, and I think that over the next 12 to 18 months, that audience who are using Snapchat will grow a little bit, or it'll go a little bit more mainstream. So that audience will grow.
So the big social media platform that we haven't spoken about is LinkedIn, and it's traditionally a business – well, it's not traditionally. It is a business-to-business platform. Is there any value in rights holders focusing on it as a channel that can provide value to their sponsors?
Potentially. I mean, there's nothing really stopping them using the company page to put out a little bit of content. LinkedIn is trying to be a bit more of a content platform now. So there is some value in making sure that your digital team is posting up something on that channel, but it doesn't need to be, at the velocity of all the tweets that are coming out, and it doesn't have to be in the fan engagement space that sort of Facebook would be driven at. But it also doesn't hurt because you will have a lot of corporate support on LinkedIn. LinkedIn is still, powerful, more so from a rights holder and a sponsorship executive point of view, to stay connected with your Rolodex and know where people are moving. So, that's where LinkedIn's power is. I haven't really seen many teams unlock that. You can obviously be putting up properties that say, hey, we've got this property to sell, or this corporate hospitality option. You can put that kind of thing on LinkedIn. Its advertising platform is, good from a targeting point of view, but it's also very expensive if we compare it to Facebook. Even last year we advertised the shirts, the sleeve sponsor for one of our clients, and we pushed it out on Facebook and we targeted CMOs and people and all that kind of thing on Facebook, just to get the awareness of that the property was out there. And that didn't take too much from a budget point of view, and it got a few inquiries and was sold. I think it was sold 10 days later. So you can work around the platform, but for mine, LinkedIn is still primarily business to business. And if you're a sponsorship executive or a rights holder and you're not using LinkedIn to build out your network, you should be doing it all the time and not just when you're looking for a job.
Yeah, that's true. Is email the forgotten digital asset inside of a lot of rights holders? My experience is that email is often just used exclusively by the rights holder to sell tickets or push membership or merchandise sales. Are rights holders and brands utilising email well, do you think?
I think email is, a trusted soldier in the digital space. It does sell a lot of tickets. It does sell a lot of merch. It does, does move the right traffic if you're doing the right segmentation. I think it's in the mix of things that a rights holder can offer. But it's just not as sexy as all the new platforms. So, It really does come down to, what type of email comms your team puts out every week. And that varies between team to team and league to league. And so it's just a matter of how much you put in that space. But to a certain degree, if a sponsor puts something in an email newsletter, it is seen as an ad. And so it is something that is brushed over.
And we see that in some of the benefits when we're setting up sponsor the system for people, is that some of those digital assets are exactly what they're selling. They're selling ads in our monthly newsletter.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know they're going to be just as successful as ads in any other place. And they're not going to be that successful. Mm. You know, whereas it might be better, again, if I'm a rights holder, you know, it might be better to say, I want one email that goes out to the specific demographic that's already shown interest because they've entered a couple of our competitions that drives people to a special event where we get 5 sales. Like, you know, that kind of email rather than the machine gun approach of send this offer out to everybody. Again, I think the value's in the niche. Like, if you can target a specific segment of a database with a specific message and it's a single message and you're the only message, I think there's far more value in that.
Yeah, and I think none of this stuff really exists in silos, and there's great opportunities for them to leverage each other. I mean, I wrote a blog post a couple of months ago about why your Facebook competitions for sponsors suck, because I saw a rights holder running a competition which was basically, tell us what you'd love about this destination, because one of the sponsors was a destination, like a resort yep. type thing, and it was just tell us what you'd love or something, and you can get 2 nights and massages and dinner and all that sort of stuff. And I looked at that and I thought, why aren't they capturing email addresses to help build an audience for that sponsor to then email those people and say, look, sorry you didn't win, but here's a 20% off voucher or a free massage if you book in October or whatever it is.
But that's a classic case of square peg, round hole. Mm. They're going, hey, we've got this, we're going to put it out, but not even looking at what they're trying to do.
Yeah. Give your services a plug, mate. Tell us about your digital health check that you offer organisations and what some of the key elements are and how it can help a rights holder on the sponsorship front.
Yeah, so going back before, sort of what I've been doing in the past couple of years is sort of I get in that review mode at the end of the season around all things content, and sort of done a lot of stuff with the digital guys. And so what I've done is I've cobbled together all of those sessions and those workshops into what I've now phrased digital health check, where we go through a content audit and review all the content that gets created. Out of that, we get a resourcing plan so we know where all the pain was happened, who was stretched the most. But then more importantly, we start building out these audience profiles of all the different types of audiences that we have served from a content point of view, whether it be the super fan, you know, the super avid fan that consumes everything to the less, you know, less engaged fan or specific segments, whether that means, you know, young teens or families, those kind of things. That helps give the content team a lot more clarity on who they're doing the content for. But then also those audience profiles also are really valuable from a commercial point of view. So the last thing that we do when reviewing the content is how well has the content been commercialized. So I get all of the every single piece of content, whether it be a long form article, a video piece, to, you know, a simple Instagram post. Try to name everything. If you can't name pieces of your content, then your sponsorship executives can't sell it. They can't sell the, yeah, we take a photo every most weeks of the stadium. You can't sell that. You can't sell that to a sponsor. Whereas if you say, every week we have a stadium shot that we share on Instagram, that now has the ability to be a brandable property. So it gives the content team and the digital team a little bit more of a commercial lens on what they're doing, because I get them to rate all of their content from a traffic perspective, an engagement perspective, and then also a commercial perspective. And so by doing that, we automatically find high traffic items that are highly engaged with our audience that don't have any commercialization on them. So normally as a byproduct of the report, and I present it back to the digital team and also the commercial team, we get a whole bunch of assets that the commercial team can go out there and sell right away, saying, hey, we've got these options, which they can either go back to sponsors with or to new sponsors. And then we start using those audiences to start developing these campaign ideas, because the digital team knows who they can target and what type of content they're doing. They can see any gaps in the space. If they want to make sure they're growing their family, their family audience and their family attending games, well, they can adjust their content plan to make sure that audience is getting well served by content, getting well served by by sponsorship and commercial options. And so it sort of just straightens things up a little bit. But yeah, the real big benefit is, you know, it does help build that process and relationship between the digital and the commercial teams, because the digital team has a lot more, you know, commercial focus on what they're doing. So if they come up with a great idea, which most digital teams do, but then they go, well, who are we doing it for? What audience is it for? And how could sponsorship commercialize it? That's a better process for that that content to be to come from, rather than we're going to do this cool piece of content because we think it's cool. And so it starts that conversation sooner. You know, even in inception stage on the digital side of things, once it's even in, you know, we've got an idea, we want to do it, we're going to pitch it to this type of sponsor, and it's going to be published here, here and here. You can go really quickly to a commercial team and they can say, oh yes, I've got a sponsor, you know, either in the pipeline or that I know would really like that piece of content. You can sort of start attributing more revenue back to digital, because the sponsorship guys are able to close deals. So, you know, commercial and sponsorship and the digital team should be best friends. Not always the case. but hopefully this process does help that process out.
Cool. And we'll put some links up in the show notes to that digital health check. Now, Sean, on your podcast, the Sports Geek podcast, you close off with what you call the starting five questions. And it's always a nice little bit of fun to close things off with. And so I thought it would be a good opportunity as we close to turn the tables a little bit and put you through the starting five questions. So the first one is, first sports event attended?
I think I'm pretty sure it was a football game. I think it would have been a VFL game out at Waverley. I think it was Collingwood, St Kilda. And I think it was actually the game that Brian Taylor kicked his 100th goal.
Yeah, right. Did you run on the field?
1987. No, I think I don't think my dad let me do that, and I think we were a bit too far away, but I do remember everyone storming the field.
Favourite food at a sports event?
Things are getting fancier and fancier every time I go. There's some crazy food that I've seen in the States, but it's more intimidating than favourite. but I actually don't mind, and it's probably more a welcome home type of thing, because I travel so much. I travel seat every year in July, and then I come back to Australia in the middle of winter. I don't mind actually going to the MCG and just getting a meat pie with sauce if that says that I'm home.
And they're a little bit cheaper than they used to be.
Oh, just a little bit, yeah.
Man. First app you open in the morning?
So for me, I open up Facebook. The whole Facebook is your personalised newspaper. I guess seeing that Mark Zuckerberg launched a couple of years ago, he seems to be hitting it pretty right for me. I can catch up on most of the key news and key things I need to look at. So, yeah, I'll open up Facebook first thing.
Inside sponsorship listeners should follow who and why?
Good mate of mine out of New Zealand. He worked on the Rugby World Cup in 2011. He came back to work with the Asian Cup and then jumped back to New Zealand. He's the CEO of Westpac Stadium, Shane Harmon. He's, you know, one of the brightest guys I know in the sports business space. He's a bit like me. He's in that we both read a lot of stuff on the internet in the sports business space and share it freely via Twitter. So if you follow Shane, both his Twitter, and he's also, if you're looking for a good flipboard, he's got a Sports Business Today flipboard magazine that's, I think, the largest followed flipboard magazine in the sports business space. Shane's a great guy. If you get a chance to meet him and have a beer, do so. But definitely give him a follow.
And we'll put some links to Shane in the show notes. Last one in the starting five, what social media platform is your MVP?
Yeah, I'm in on Team Facebook at the minute, especially just primarily because the advertising and targeting options success that we've had, both from a selling tickets point of view, so selling tickets with partners like the Asia Cup, but then also, you know, the options that it offers to reach all of your fans. So Facebook is for mine.
Sean, if people want to get in contact with you, find out more about what you do, etc., where should they go?
SportsGeekHQ.com is where all things all Sports Geek are. I'm Sean Callanan on most platforms, Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat and the like, and the same on LinkedIn. So if you can't find me on the internet, then I'm not doing my job right.
Sean Callanan from Sports Geek, on behalf of the listeners, thank you so much for taking us inside the digital assets of sponsorship programs.
No worries, Dan.
Super chat with Sean, and again, thanks so much for the extended period of time he put into that interview. It's greatly appreciated. Sean's a smart guy and practical in his approaches, so be sure to check out his website and the Sports Geek podcast. Of course, there are all those links to the show notes at sponsorv.net to cover off all those things that we spoke about. Also, thanks to Mark for spending some time with us and discussing how to actually build relationships with sponsors. If you aren't already, be sure to subscribe to receive all our content straight to your inbox. Simply head along to any of our blogs or podcasts at sponsorv.net and fill in the subscription form and we'll hook you up. If you want to be even more connected to Sponserve, then you can find us on Facebook and Twitter or connect with Mark Thompson or myself, Daniel Oyston, on LinkedIn. If you have an idea for a guest or just a general topic, a segment idea, or even a question, be sure to get in contact and we will see if we can include it in the show. Or just shoot us an email and say hi and we'll give you a shout out. Lastly, if you could head along to iTunes and give us a little review, we would be very, very grateful as it helps us get the best practice sponsorship content we produce out to more people. Until next time, thanks for listening to Inside Sponsorship.
Thanks for listening to the show. For more episodes, blogs and resources, head to sponsorv.net or search for Sponserve on Facebook, Twitter or LinkedIn.